Welcome to Stateside and happy Monday. Hope you had a wonderful holiday weekend. I'm Cynthia Canty. Canada dumping its garbage in Michigan. On today's show, we look at why it is so cheap to haul trash over the border and the political reasons that make it so hard to stop. And then the rise of the pop-up, why temporary businesses are springing up and finding success. But first, to the state's highest court. On Friday, the Michigan Supreme Court said it would not make an early ruling on the constitutionality of the state's new right-to-work law. Governor Snyder had asked the high court to decide the issue before the cases made its way through lower courts. The law was passed last December during a very controversial lame-duck legislative session. Under the law, workers cannot be forced to pay union dues or fees as a condition of employment. Let's bring in Chris Gouts to help break this all down for us. Chris is the Capitol correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business. Chris, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So the court announced on Friday that it would not take up the issue, at least not yet. Just tell us why Governor Snyder had wanted an early decision.
Well, he wanted an early decision for several reasons. One is because there are already several lawsuits that are out there right now that were challenging this law in various courts and in various steps of the process. And he wanted to get the Supreme Court to say, you know, to bypass all that and just say for certain, yes, it's constitutional or no, it's not. So there wouldn't be this ambiguity and this, sort of concern about, because eventually it would get to the Supreme Court anyway. So he just wanted to skip those steps and just take it to that point already. And the biggest reason for him would seem to be the issue of state employees. Because they are going to be starting their contract negotiations at either the end of this month or early August. And about 70% of the state's workforce, about 50,000, are unionized employees. And so this is of paramount importance to them to answer this question. And there is a current court case pending over that issue, which is now before the State Court of Appeals. What the Supreme Court said basically is that, you know, we're going to let them do their business. And then if it comes to us, then we'll decide whether or not we're going to take it up. The big question now is whether or not once that Court of Appeals ruling comes down, how soon or if the Supreme Court will rule on that question, because the contracts for state employees end at the end of the year. And so this is of major importance. So if this doesn't get decided, I can just imagine, you know, the state employee unions, of which I think there are a half dozen that represent those 35,000 workers, are going to be sitting on one side of the table and the state's going to sit on the other, and they're just going to sit there twiddling their thumbs while this major issue sort of hangs out there. And until that's decided, I don't think you're going to have a final contract with these workers.
Chris, what was your sense of the reason why the high court said, no, we're not going to make an early decision? What was behind that?
I think part of it was, like I said, that was already so far along in the process in terms of the issue of the state employees. It was already at the Court of Appeals level, and I believe that they are all done with any oral arguments or you know, testimony, written testimony. So I think they're ready to decide, and so I think it was probably just a practical matter of saying, you know, do we really want to take this out of their hands after they've done all this work? I mean, that could be one factor. And I've talked to some labor attorneys who also thought that this was kind of a surprise that they didn't take it up, in the sense that there is this large conservative majority on the court, and you would think that just given the political nature that some believe is there, that they would have sided with the governor and just taken up the issue, because many believe that no matter whenever it gets to the Supreme Court, they're going to side with the state. And so that they were a little surprised that just didn't happen this time around.
So what does this all mean now, Chris Gouts, for the new law, that just it remains in place as all of this other action is happening in the lower courts?
Yeah, barring any injunction, nothing changes in terms of the law. It's still an enforceable law, and it's in effect, and nothing changes that unless there is an injunction with one of these other proceedings. Like I said, there is the case involving the state employees at the Court of Appeals level. There is another issue over whether the law should be even allowed, because the ACLU says that it violated the Open Meetings Act by passing the law during a time at which the doors to the Capitol were locked. Although even the judge in that case has said that it's very unlikely, I forget the exact words, but basically gave the impression to the other side, saying you have a very uphill battle on your hands here. And then there was another suit in federal court from the AFL-CIO who's trying to say that this there's a supremacy clause with the U.S. Constitution, and so the Michigan did not have the right to preempt that ability for workers to have this kind of ability to bargain and collectively. Although, unless there is an injunction granted by the federal judge in that case, who is a Bush appointee, I don't think that nothing will change in terms of the effect ongoing right now for businesses or for state workers.
Now, that argument that's in front of the federal court about the supremacy is kind of an interesting one, which it seems to me that might get further than, gee, they locked the doors in Lansing. What are you hearing from attorneys and experts as far as which of these cases might make the biggest impact?
Honestly, none of them. They don't see any of these going against the state, especially with the AFL-CIO case, trying to say that it can't apply because of federal law. The problem with that is that, and the Attorney General has made this point in his brief, is that there are 23 other states that already are right to work. Mm-hmm. And in many of those cases, the state law is based off of some of those other states. And so if there was a legal issue to be made, you would think that one of the unions in those other states in the however many years, you know, those 23 other states enacted their statutes, that there would have been a case to be made at the federal level. And there hasn't been. So here the union is trying to say that Michigan law was similar in some respects, but it went much farther than some of the other states. But the Attorney General, when he laid out in his brief, he showed how in various parts of the statutes, how many other states have either identical or nearly identical language to what those other states have done. And so he thinks that, you know, the idea that Michigan is somehow so totally different than these other states, it just doesn't hold weight.
So looking forward, Chris, what do you feel as you've very clearly shown us, the ship has sailed legally and there are lawsuits moving along in the lower courts. What do you think the timeline is for all of these challenges and what should we keep an eye on?
You know, trying to guess the time frame of any judge or any court is not something that I want to get involved in or put money on. So I don't know. I think the biggest question, though, to be like I said before, is to watch the timing of the state employee issue, because that is going to be a very big question, and you're not going to see a resolution on that contract. You'll just probably have to have contract extensions if the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals does not rule before the end of the year. That one's going to be a very big deal because that wouldn't be – and the reason for that is that because the state employee contracts are expiring, that means this would be a new contract, which means that the right to work rule would kick in for them, which means that they could no longer be in the union, that they could – you know, they have the full power under this new right to work law. And the whole argument there is that these employees do not fall under right to work because they are protected in the Constitution. And the Michigan Civil Service Commission is supposed to have sole authority over such issues. And that's at the heart of the lawsuit. So until that's determined, that's just going to be something that's really hanging out there, and it's going to hold up any further negotiations.
Chris Gouts is the Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you've ever visited the White House, you know it's an exciting, exciting memory that you'll always treasure. But how many of us can say, not only did we visit the White House, we were invited to have lunch with the First Lady of the United States? Well, my next guest is going to be able to say exactly that. Jake Hirsch of Bloomfield Hills is 8 years old, and tomorrow Jake will be a guest at a kids' state dinner hosted by none other than First Lady Michelle Obama. It's actually a healthy lunch, and it's part of the First Lady's Let's Move initiative, trying to tackle childhood obesity and get kids eating healthy. Jacob won his invitation by submitting a healthy recipe in a big national competition, and out of more than 1,300 entries, Jacob's Picky Eater Pizza Pockets was one of 54 winners. So Jake Hirsch and his mom, Sarah, join us in the studio. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So Jake, are you excited about going to the White House?
Yes.
Tell us about the recipe that you submitted to win this contest. Tell me about Picky Eater Pizza Pockets.
Well, at the bottom there's pita, then there's a healthy tomato sauce, and then there's cheese, and then there's chicken.
The reason that we created this recipe is because Jacob's kind of a picky eater, and he It's difficult to get vegetables into his body, so the way we sometimes have to do it is by pureeing them into sauces. So it's actually all the vegetables are in the sauce.
Ah.
So there's carrots and onions and zucchini blended in with tomatoes. Then you have your picky eater pita pizza pocket.
Now, how did you hear about this the contest, this Let's Move contest and the challenge?
I found out about it online. I do sometimes like to look for contests for my kids to enter. And
a little, don't you mean
a lot? A lot.
So when I found this one, I mean, this is such a great prize and such a rare opportunity. So I made sure both of my kids entered, and Jacob was the one that won.
So I have to ask you, when you found out that you were the winner for the whole state of Michigan, what did that feel like?
Awesomeness.
Awesomeness. Did you get an email? Did you get a phone call? How'd you find out?
An email.
And what did you think when you read it?
Awesome.
About going to the White House?
Yeah.
So, Jacob, what are you most excited about with your trip to the White House?
Eating lunch in the White House.
I'd say most of us would add that. That would be a pretty awesome thing. So you have to send us a picture if you get a picture after, okay?
Okay.
Well, it's a lot of fun to meet you, and your picky eater pizza pockets sound really, really good.
Okay.
All right. Hey, thank you for coming in, and good luck with your trip to Washington tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
8-year-old Jake Hirsch of Bloomfield Hills is Michigan's winner in the First Lady's 2013 Healthy Lunchtime Challenge after his recipe was chosen from over 1,300 submissions. And tomorrow, Jacob and 53 other young winners will be the guest of Mrs. Michelle Obama at the Kids' State Dinner at the White House. Coming up next, the rise of the pop-up. Temporary businesses are gaining traction after the down economy left many storefronts empty. What does it mean for your local economy? This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it used to be when you'd think of a pop-up business, you'd pretty much think of those Halloween stores that pop up every September, or the fireworks tents that happen every July, or maybe the Christmas tree and wreath lots that happen every Thanksgiving. But the pop-up is growing and spreading, and temporary businesses are gaining traction in cities and towns where the Great Recession left many empty storefronts. And the pop-up works on so many levels, both for the entrepreneur and for the business districts and the cities who see new life being breathed into buildings and areas that have been way too quiet. Let's talk pop-ups as we welcome Brian Ellison. He's a business advocate for the city of Detroit, and as such, he helps pop-up businesses navigate the world of permits and governmental regulations. Hello, Brian.
Hi, how are you, Cynthia?
Good. Good to have you with us on Stateside. And we're also joined by Angela Foster. Angela's a pastry chef who operated a pop-up coffee shop on Detroit's east side for the month-long project called June on Jefferson, put on by the Jefferson East Business Association. Her shop is called Coffee and... and you get to fill in the blank. Angela, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Brian, what do you feel is behind the growth in pop-up businesses?
I think within the city of Detroit, there's probably a couple of different factors that you're seeing contributing to the emergence of the pop-up retail phenomenon. One, we do have a large number of vacant areas, which were previously commercial districts within the city. And while they're not completely vacant, when we look at avenues such as Livernois or Woodward and downtown, there's enough vacancy there and enough lack of use that landlords or the city are willing to work with folks to get them in on a temporary basis to, A, revitalize the property, and, B, from the business owner's perspective, offer them an opportunity to kind of test the waters at a relatively low cost.
So it really is win-win for both sides of this equation.
Absolutely. And then I guess there's probably a third side as well that needs to be looked at, which is the communities where these businesses are locating. They're bringing amenity back, in many cases, to areas that have been without for 10 years or more.
When we talk about pop-up businesses, Brian Ellison, as you work with them for the city of Detroit, what kinds of businesses are we referring to?
You know, there's a pretty broad spectrum. What I've seen of late is... retail, and this has come in the form of retail from established companies such as Moose Jaw. That would be a test case scenario in a relatively high visibility area on Woodward. That's a pop-up that went to permanent fixture. It took on a permanent lease. But we're also seeing a lot at the community level around food, such as Angela's Coffee Shop, and retail, small retail. And it can be everything from art prints and some clothing, and then food and drinks.
Angela Foster, you moved from being a pastry chef at a leading hotel to operating pop-up coffee shops. I'm wondering, what are you getting out of running the pop-ups that you were not getting from working for the big-name hotel?
Well, instant gratification. So I'm right there when I see everybody eat my pastries, and it's great. And a community. So when I worked at the hotels, I mean, did anybody really care? I did, because it really helped me hone my craft. I learned from some of the best pastry chefs in the world. So that was 9 years ago. And so I opened my first pop-up last fall in the West Village to simply meet my neighbors. Huh. It was just a block down the street. I didn't do it for any other reason. That was it. I just wanted to know the community I was living in. And then it changed into something else. I realized that people really liked the things I was baking. And it was hard to get a job. I applied everywhere in Detroit to work anywhere, in a restaurant, in a catering company, but no one knew me. I was just like everyone else with a culinary degree. So it gave me a way to make a living doing pastry again, but by being with people and doing something really good, I think, for neighborhoods that aren't just mine, because now I've popped up 2 miles down the road in Jefferson East. And it's just an amazing welcome I've gotten. They don't really care that I don't live in Jeff Chalmers. They just care that I'm a Detroiter that is there doing it. And it's, I think, built a tremendous amount of community in that area.
What advantages does a pop-up offer to an entrepreneur?
Well, you're a litmus test, really. So you get a chance to, just as Brian said earlier, test the waters. Is this a viable enough location for a business? Are there enough people in the surrounding neighborhood and community that will support you? Can you get enough draw by social media to attract people from across Detroit? Can we get them coming all the way from Corktown, all the way from Midtown, where there's plenty of coffee shops? Can we get them coming from Sterling Heights just to check out the new place? And it also gives you a chance to figure out how tight you can run your ship, as well as how much you could afford to pay in rent if you were to do it on your own.
Brian Ellison, as you work with pop-up businesses for the city of Detroit, you talked about the immediate impact of getting people coming into areas that had been way too quiet, such as the June on Jefferson event that's been going on for a month. But what do you hope to see in terms of long-range impact from pop-ups?
You know, ideally, I kind of see two outcomes that I hope for. First is that the existing pop-up entrepreneurs are successful, and that's proven. So the amenity now is in the community, which is twofold, right? It services the needs of that community or the wants of that community, as well as providing a living for somebody who's doing their passion in this place. So then they go on and become permanent, and then secondarily, that more entrepreneurs try out Detroit in a relatively cost-efficient manner.
It's very nimble and it's cost efficient. Angela, would you want to create more pop-ups, or do you want to use your pop-up coffee shop to transition into a permanent business?
That's a great question. I would love to keep doing what I'm doing forever, but I don't know if I know how to run a business exactly. I know how to bake, and I know how to welcome people, and I know how to work every single day, 30 days straight, because I'm the one that does all the baking and I'm the one that does all the work. I'm not sure if I know how to train others to do what I do, because I've never really done that before. So I would love to keep popping up, but then I also think, doesn't that get a little strange? Like, here she is again popping up. And so many people have asked me to go permanent because they enjoy it so much, and then I wonder, will it wear off? Because I'm not a pop-up anymore. Oh, she's there every day. You know, mm-hmm. Will people come? So I don't know the answer. I think it's a lot of fun figuring out if a space is busy enough for a business or if your concept is good enough for a business. But I think what I would like to see is somebody come in there who really knows how to run a business and has investors and has the money to go in there and do it and do it right. I don't know that I have all of that.
You've got the art part of it down, but let someone else handle the business part, I think I'm hearing.
I think so. Maybe if I do two more pop-ups, by then I'll be, you know, Miss Businesswoman. But right now I just know that I love to bake and I love people. I love hospitality.
Brian, what would you advise both would-be entrepreneurs and local government leaders who are listening to us all over Michigan about the do's and don'ts of pop-up businesses?
If I was speaking to the entrepreneurs, and I do quite often, I like to go through some basic ground rules, if you will, that have worked for us. I know that from a business perspective, part of the idea of utilizing the pop-up model is that you can create a cost-efficient, quick access way to get a property back in use. So what you want to do is you want to deal with a property that is as close to viable, you know, structurally as possible. Pop-ups are generally not held to a very high standard of decor by their user, but we do have a standard of safety and engineering. So, you know, the space needs to be safe. To that end, to reduce costs, and a lot of our pop-ups will work with an agency such as the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation and their Revolve program, where they're able to seed funds into getting some of these facilities operational. So contacting them is critical, in my opinion. Also, when you're working with the city under our zoning or code regulations, you want to make sure that the previous use of the building is relatively closely aligned to what you want to do. And the reason I say that is this. If you have a use or a prior use that was very, very different from what you're looking to do, you're going to encounter challenges with obtaining a change of use permit, which means you're going to have to go to boards, which means increased cost, reduced efficiency in getting into the space. So basically, long story short, due diligence. And there are resources. You can contact Buildings and Safety and say, look, I'm looking to do a pop-up in this address. They can pull the address, tell you what the previous use was, tell you the existing conditions of the building if you can't get them readily from the landlord. And we are more than willing to work with you to do that. You can also, again, reach out to an agency such as the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation here, and they can point you in the direction of resources to get your space set up for a retail operation. I would say when speaking to other people in government, one, it's being open and creative in your thinking. Sometimes we become become very set in the way we perceive a retail space to look or a restaurant to look. And a lot of times, you know, a pop-up will create exactly the same amenity and perhaps the aesthetic is different, you know, or perhaps the model is different than something that you're used to seeing. And sometimes it's just something that may seem different for that area. I like to say, you know, let the entrepreneur or let the operator figure those pieces out. Sometimes in government we become very restrictive and don't let the entrepreneurs run the risk. They're doing an analysis. Angela did an analysis. She knows the community. She put her coffee shop in. Fortunately, one of them was the one that I live in, and she does make great pastries, by the way, just a side note.
Thank you, Brian.
So, I mean, you know, let the creative minds, let the entrepreneurs, let them bring an amenity and be open.
Angela, in our last minute, what's the biggest piece of advice you would offer to someone who would love to make their dream a reality?
I think the biggest piece of advice I would have is just be you. Say everything you want to say and do everything you want to do. It worked for me. I didn't even realize that I had a big dream or a big goal until I saw the call for proposals. And then all of a sudden I had an idea. And I just wrote it all down, and Revolve Detroit and the DEGC loved it. And they allowed me just to do that. with the Jefferson East Business Association, we had a lot more parameters to work with. We were dealing with the American Institute of Architects. I had a crew of 8 designers who were working with me, and we had a board. And so we had to deal with what everyone else wanted. And so I did that, but I said, I want to be open every day, not just Friday and Saturday for June on Jefferson. And they were a little leery, and I kept pushing and kept pushing. And they said, okay. And I did it, and they said, thank you. This has been great. So I think just knowing what you want and being able to speak it and then do it.
That was pastry chef Angela Foster, who's been operating pop-up coffee shops, coffee and, you can fill in the blank, is the most recent one she's been operating with the Jefferson East Business Association. We've also been speaking with Brian Ellison with the City of Detroit. Thank you so much to both of you for talking with us on Stateside today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Think about who you were in your late teens and if there were people who helped guide you into adulthood. What if those people had not been in your life? Many kids who are runaways or homeless have little support or few good role models in their lives.
They don't have anybody who's there to show them how they're supposed to do things. They don't have leaders. They really have to become their own. They have to really step up and get things accomplished without the support of others. So if they don't have those leadership skills, unfortunately, a lot of times, they're just going to get lost.
That's Matt Cornelia. He works as a case manager at The Connection. It's a center in Livingston County that provides transitional housing and counseling for at-risk and homeless youth. The center has its own youth council made up of homeless teenagers and people in their early 20s. They plan events and make decisions about the center. 2 years ago, the council decided they wanted to learn how to become better leaders while also networking with other homeless kids from around the state. So the Youth Council created a day-long conference and held its second conference this year. The attendees ranged in ages from 13 to 21. They took classes. They listened to a motivational speaker that got them pumped. Matt Cornelia from The Connection says there was a lot of energy in the room.
I had a lot of kids, you know, throwing high fives, getting really excited. You could tell that this really meant something to these kids. They were very involved and opening up to each other. And certainly, there's not a lot of people out there saying, you're valuable, you're worth it. So to get this opportunity for all these different groups to share that, it really is important.
Another big hit of the day was a performance by a theater troupe. The actors improvised several skits about conflicts kids have with their parents and about unhealthy relationships.
Family! Family! Look at me. I'm your family. I'm here for you for everything.
Then the actors improvised potential solutions. And that was 19-year-old Brooklyn Nick's favorite part of the day. He's from Grand Rapids. He currently lives with his dad, but says he's been close to being homeless many times. Watching the skits between the parents and kids hit home for Nick's. He said he wished he'd been able to problem solve and talk in positive, healthy ways with his parents. Nick says conferences like this one, where young people can talk about their lives, are really important.
Everyone can share their problems and they can express how they are the same. Because, you know, being homeless is scary. Being alone is scary.
Another person who felt that sense of loneliness was 19-year-old Siobhan Morgan from Flint. After the conference, there was a barbecue for the kids. Keep in mind, going to a normal summer barbecue can be a rare event for a lot of these youth, who sometimes are out of contact with their family and friends. At the barbecue, Siobhan Morgan spent a lot of her time nailing her three-pointer on the basketball court. Morgan says she's glad she came, and she was encouraged by the conference.
Because I do have low self-esteem, and by them telling me that I can reach out and become anything if I work hard enough, I think I can really use that. I really needed somebody to tell me that because I have nobody to rely on. So, you know, these seminars that we have, I think they're great for us because we actually learn from them.
Siobhan Morgan says coming to this event was a big deal for her. On a scale of 1 to 10, she says it was a 10. She also said the food was good, and the people she met made her feel like family.
This story was produced by Kyle Norris and Katie Theory. Still to come, we take a look at why it is so cheap, so easy to haul Canadian trash over our border and the political reasons making it hard to stop. That story in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. As revenue shrank and budget holes grew, the city of Detroit turned to its three casinos for badly needed tax revenue and jobs. And at a time when an emergency manager is running the show and bankruptcy looms, it is not great news to hear all three Detroit casinos posted a decline in revenue from May 2012 to May 2013. Jake McLogic is the president of Michigan Consultants. He's an economic analyst. Welcome, Jake.
My honor.
Well, before we dig into what you think might be causing the revenue drop, can you give us a sense of just how much these three casinos matter to Detroit's economy?
Well, they're pretty essential right now. They're probably together one of the largest private employers, if not the largest. It depends how you count the medical center. So the money does stay in the community that way and leads also to city income taxes and employees and their own property taxes. And that's not always appreciated, is how much other government revenue comes from other sources, not just the revenue tax paid.
I saw one figure that the casinos paid $177 million last year, plus another $23 million in fees for public safety and other services. That's a pretty good chunk of money in a city that is desperate for every dollar.
Yeah, it is. And it comes off the top of revenues. It's not a profit tax. Some people don't understand.
And, explain that for us, for those of us who don't.
Well, if someone says, gee, my tax rate's 30%, well, that's tax rates on profits. With the casinos, it's a revenue to pay it every day. So if they bring in $5 million that day, pretty much 18-19% right off the top goes to the state and city. Mm-hmm. They never really see it. It just flows through the books. In fact, sometimes even if they give out cashback rewards to bring people in, there's a tax even on that. So it's important income to the city at a time that and there's no tax breaks they get. They put in new hotels, heavily subsidized by the city, special tax breaks. The casino hotels pay full property taxes, full rates and stuff.
So we're talking a lot of money, and when we look at this overall total revenue shrinkage from spring of last year to spring of this year. I mean, it's such a pattern of blaming things like this on the Great Recession, but we're moving up and out of that, no?
Well, yeah. In fact, we predicted, not all our predictions are right, most of them are, but it was in the press. We predicted a 4% hit from the Ohio casinos. Detroit was going up at a rate of 2%, and now they're down 2%.
So and the Ohio voters said yes to casino gambling in 2009. So when was it over, like the last year or so when we saw these casinos?
Toledo opened just a little over a year ago. And it's not only the Ohio players, it's not a group we're talking about,
right,
but the old casino players there, but even Monroe County, even up to Washtenaw County. Some people go down to Toledo now rather than driving in Detroit. It's got to be convenience and cleanliness for any casino. You try and offer something special, it's very hard. Almost all the games are the same.
Yeah.
So it's just supply and demand. And when Toledo opened and Cleveland, Cincinnati, that money is going to stay. And that's the purpose. That's why they did it.
Sure.
We did Detroit, so the money didn't go to Windsor. So really the demand has not decreased. It's just where it goes. And some of it's now going to Toledo.
There you go, the Hollywood Casino. So easy to get to right off I-75.
It is.
Can't miss that.
And even to some extent, Emmett Township by Battle Creek is right off 94.
I wondered, are we seeing any kind of similar decline in the casinos elsewhere in Michigan? Because certainly Firekeepers there in Battle Creek is just going gangbusters, it seems, with the new hotel and filled parking lots.
Yeah. I work with almost all of them, mm-hmm. or have once upon a time. There is a decline. Firekeepers, really, their challenge is going to be the Gun Lake Casino out in Grand Rapids area in Wayland Township, and how that affects them. They are really God's gift to casino placement. I mean, if you're 94 and 60, 69, you're near two interstates. I think one time I noticed they're even closer to Fort Wayne in drive time than would be the Pokagon facility out in New Buffalo.
Okay.
And are even east Chicago places, things like that. So the point being that that's a great location. But again, you know, the casinos do well and some of them overbuild. Detroit casinos were doing great financially during the temporary, but then they built and these great foyers and $1 billion, $2 billion in debt. That's very hard on them. And some of these other casinos, I don't know about Full House. Well, mm-hmm. the Firekeepers, Full House doesn't do it anymore. Place up in Petoskey, several of them overbuilt. So the revenues are still there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a slight decline, but maybe even a slight increase. But they take on so much debt that then they run into financial problems. And a lot of casinos in this country are in financial problems because of the debt.
How can Detroit's casinos, in your view, market themselves in the face of this Ohio competition and the fact that, unlike going to Petoskey, which is a travel tourist destination where you're up, I'm going up north, I'm going to be on the lake, Detroit does not have that allure. How ought they be marketing themselves?
Well, they should be have an allure, and they should say they're on a lake, on a river. They got
true
sports, plays, music. I'd like to see, I've always said, the three do not work together. There's no association. What they do is they, you know, the old term was cannibalize, which maybe is a poor term anymore, but they fight each other for the same patron. And that's a losing game eventually. You're not going to increase Detroit revenues by stealing one versus another. You're going to have to get some new patrons in and hopefully patrons from further away to bring money to Detroit. And obviously, if you get them from other countries or other states, that's even better. But that advertising really has not occurred of pushing the whole city with them participating in a big, strong, dynamic way.
Good insights, Jake McLochick, who is the president of Michigan Consultants Economic Analyst. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio, Jake.
My honor.
Michigan's known for its lakes, great and small, rivers, forests, campgrounds, and for being a great cheap place to dump your trash, at least if you're a Canadian waste hauler. Consider this. It costs $64 to dump a ton of trash in a landfill in Windsor. On the U.S. side of the border, you'd pay $12.99 a ton in Wisconsin. But here in Michigan, 21 cents per ton. You heard that right, 21 cents. And that Canadian trucker that's hauling the trash pays only $5 to cross the border. Small wonder Michigan's become a mighty attractive destination for Canadian businesses looking to get rid of trash. Joining us is Barry Rabe with the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Barry, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So, Barry, how is it Michigan, as I said, got so cheap and easy and has become Canada's personal trash heap?
Well, Michigan did make a substantial investment. Our communities in Michigan made substantial investments in expanding solid waste capacity several decades ago when there were concerns about shortages and the like. That clearly led to questions about how Michigan was going to deal with these issues long term. And also, as you know, it made Michigan a pretty attractive destination. Now, the biggest player there crossing the international border, and of course Michigan and Ontario have a huge, huge border, mm-hmm. has been trash from Toronto. And the interesting story there is that our Toronto neighbors have seemingly found a way to deal with most of their issue within their province. And so a good portion of that cross-border shipment has begun to dwindle in recent years.
So, and we certainly know Senators Levin and Stabenow have been tackling this issue, and they did manage to get that law passed that banned municipal waste from Canada, but that was, what, about 40% of the Canadian garbage?
It was. I do think it's safe to say, though, that the reaction from the political leaders in the state and the recognition in Toronto that Michigan might not be a long-term welcoming home, if you will, really led the leadership in Toronto to consider other options. And there are really two things that they've been doing. A lot of this got triggered by about 12, 13 years ago, a very, very large landfill called Keel Valley that was owned by Toronto had to close. That's where all of Toronto's garbage was going.
Okay.
There was no interest in another landfill. There was no interest in an incinerator. They were trying to move on recycling and had issues, and they looked over the Ambassador Bridge, and hey, there were all those landfills in southeastern Michigan.
Charging 21 cents a ton.
There you go. What a deal. But then as the pressure began to elevate, over time, what has been decided is that Toronto has pretty substantially expanded some of their recycling programs and trying to reduce the amount that have to go to landfill or anywhere else. But in London, not the UK London, but London in Western Ontario, Toronto now owns what's called Green Lane, which is a very, very large landfill owned, purchased by the City of Toronto, and most of the waste from Toronto is being now diverted there, which is supposed to be a solution that's going to last them through about 2025.
But then for Michigan, with the Canadian trash, that's some 60% that's coming from private commercial sites. What's that mean for us and for our landfills?
That's right. So we're talking about Greater Toronto, which is a huge huge portion, but when we look at Ontario, it's a province that has a larger overall population than Michigan does. Like Michigan, it's a very decentralized government with lots of local communities, lots of private generators, and so you still have a large number of individual contracts between, you know, municipalities, private generators, somewhere in Ontario, presumably Western Ontario, and those Michigan landfills. So that part of it does really shift, even though you take when you take the Toronto component out, that's a pretty big chunk.
Yes. But I have to ask you, from someone like me on the outside looking in, and you see that here in Michigan we're charging that 21 cents a ton to dump waste, and then in Windsor the same thing costs $64. How did that happen?
Every government makes its decision, whether it's setting the price of gasoline, excise taxes for cigarettes, tipping fees for solid waste. Now, sometimes those decisions are taken at a state or in Canada provincial level, sometimes locally. They vary pretty substantially state by state, just as they do for other kinds of taxes. And in the area of solid waste, we've seen some nationally and across Canada as well, some pretty big differences in terms of how this has worked. This does raise a whole bunch of issues going forward in terms of, you know, what those Michigan rates would be. There's always a big issue if you set a higher rate. Means people within your state, citizens within your state or communities are paying more because it's hard under the Commerce Clause of the U.S. competition to set one standard for Michigan waste and one from waste that's coming from Ohio or Canada. And so that also becomes a big factor in this.
So that gets involved then if you're looking at it as a local or a state lawmaker thinking we could see revenue, then you're going to also gore your own ox.
That's right. And there was a lot of exploration before our Toronto neighbors found Green Lane to look at some kind of a differential fee structure or a surcharge on Canadian waste. That moves you into some pretty tricky constitutional and even political territory. At that time, while a lot of Canadian trash was coming to the U.S., a fair amount of U.S. hazardous waste was going over the Blue Water Bridge towards Sarnia into Canada. And then there began to be questions of retaliation one way or another. And before you know it, you have a kind of waste trade war, if you will. That has not happened, but that is a substantial factor, especially in the case of these tipping fees or whatever you want to call them in Michigan. You know, still the biggest customer for these are Michigan residents. And no one's too thrilled about paying more for dealing with their garbage.
Good point. We're speaking with Barry Rabe, who teaches public and environmental policy at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan, talking about trash and particularly looking at the amount of Canadian trash coming in to Michigan landfills. And I'm wondering, Barry, as you look across the United States border with Canada, what's the situation with other states that are bordering Canada? Are they as inexpensive as Michigan in terms of dumping waste?
Probably not. Again, you're bringing in a fair number of states that
yes.
have some shared border with Canada. I think it's safe to say that Michigan, because of its investments in expanding capacity, as we were noting earlier, has probably been on the lower side of this. There were some concerns some time ago about, you know, how these sorts of arrangements would emerge. I'm not aware, though, of any other state neighboring, at least Ontario, that's had the level of concern with Ontario trash coming over, as has Michigan, partly due to the proximity and the fact that right over the bridge you had all of these facilities, and then, as you know, the price differentials. So it's come up in other places, but not nearly as significantly. I would say if we're still having areas where cross-border movement of waste is contentious, it's more things such as nuclear waste, smaller amounts, but obviously a much more visible and controversial issue.
And speaking, as we did a few moments ago, about Senators Levin and Stabenow, in 2011, they tried to raise the foreign trash importation fees. They had the Stop Canadian Trash Act, and it died in committee. Why did it die?
I think there is real reluctance, given the North America Free Trade Agreement, to do anything that begins to set differential tax rates or fee rates on trash or just about anything else. We've gone through a period, actually even before the NAFTA agreement, which was truly North American, to try to create a fairly substantial zone of rapid and free movement of goods across the Canadian-U.S. border. And in many respects, it's been a remarkable, long-standing relationship, certainly in the auto industry, where we're constantly having parts and products go back and forth.
Sure.
So there's always reluctance to do anything to upend what's an unusually large but also an unusually friendly border. And again, one might begin with, say, a trash fee, but then you could envision all kinds of retaliation, whether they're environmentally related fees or other kinds of things. That's probably not the only reason why it died. I think it's always challenging to propose, in the case of the U.S. Senate or the U.S. Congress, a fee that will primarily benefit one jurisdiction, namely Michigan, when there could be cascading effects across the entire border where a lot of states are in play.
So, Barry Rabe, what do you see as the future for accepting Canadian garbage in Michigan?
Well, I do think a lot of this could be relating longer term to issues of recycling. Both Michigan and Ontario have struggled to hit some of their targets for recycling, and it opens up the age-old question, how much landfill are we going to use? Mm-hmm. We've kind of moved beyond incineration in both places. That's on the decline. Michigan has been pretty successful with its yard waste restrictions. And, of course, the bottle bill is an extraordinary story, now going on over 35 years with very high rates of return. By comparison, if you look at other areas of solid waste recycling, including some industrial solid waste that can be recycled, Michigan's on the lower end of that. Some similar issues actually in Ontario, which has a big manufacturing base, a big industrial base, bigger population base. They've struggled. Big chunks of both Ontario and Michigan don't have waste to curbside recycling. There have been reports on both sides of the border on this. And so I think one challenge going ahead for this relationship is, you know, not just how you manage the landfills over the next 10, 20 years or wait for some new technology for disposal, but can you really put a substantial dent into the actual amount that has to go to those in the first place, whether that's done locality by locality, state by state, or even collectively something across the Great Lakes Basin, which might involve Michigan and Ontario working together. To me, that's still a bigger challenge because those numbers of recycling are not where we might have expected them to be by now.
Barry Rabe teaches public and environmental policy at the University of Michigan at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy, the guy that can make talking trash understandable and enjoyable. Barry, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Good to talk with you. Thanks so much.
And that's Stateside for today. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. And let's talk again tomorrow at 3 p.m.